and the audio will be available on the PERS website within a week. This is our first hybrid meeting using this platform, and we may experience some technical difficulties as we familiarize ourselves with this platform. So thank you in advance for your patience this morning. Hosting a hybrid meeting means we have some board members and staff at the PERS headquarters boardroom with other meeting participants online. If you're online, you'll see a window showing all the board members at their usual seats and a copy of the agenda on the projector screen behind them. You may also see a window showing an in-person presenter with their camera on when appropriate. We will not have a separate window showing the board packet. It'll be in the background, as I just mentioned, but the board packet is available in the GoToWebinar link, and it's also available on the PERS website. If you're an online presenter, please turn your camera on while presenting. Otherwise, you can have your camera off. Also, please introduce yourself for the record when you begin your presentation. Board members attending in person, your microphones are probably in the off position. Please use the red button to turn them on to speak. A few other items to note. As always, public testimony will be taken on action items at the chair's discretion. Written testimony can be submitted to the PERS board email link 3 days in advance. We did not receive any testimony for this meeting. Chat function will be disabled, and we will not be monitoring the raise hand features in the meeting for attendees. With that, I will turn the meeting over to Chair Shenoy to call the meeting to order. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Good morning. Welcome, everyone, to the May Oregon PERS board meeting. After two very long and difficult years, we are able to do this hybrid meeting where some participants can attend in person and others online. Judging by the enthusiastic pre-meeting conversations, this is a very welcome progress. I'm Sadhna Shenoy, Chair of the Board, and I call this meeting to order. Could all the board members present please announce themselves?
Lawrence Forrestal.
Stephen Buckley.
Jardon Jaramillo.
John Scanlon.
Wonderful. Thank you. First item on our agenda is the approval of the May 2022 board meeting minutes. Any questions or comments on the minutes as presented? Hearing none, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
Lawrence Fernstall moves approval of the minutes.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jardon Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you, everyone. The March meeting minutes are approved. Item A2 on the agenda is the direct report, and on to Kevin.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, director. Welcome to the May 27th, 2022 board meeting. As always, this is our first hybrid board meeting. And you know, one of the benefits of this meeting format does allow for a broader group of interested parties and stakeholders to observe the meeting without having to travel to our headquarters building. We now have had staff coming back to the office, with the office reopening to the public on May 2nd. As noted in my previous reports, the majority of staff will be working remotely while still ensuring that our ongoing business needs are met. As always, we have a very interesting agenda to work through this morning. With respect to my director's report, this is a summary of items the board should be aware of and aren't a part of the board agenda materials. There's also an overview of recent agency accomplishments in this report. With respect to the forward-looking calendar, we've included future board meeting dates, as always scheduled to start at 9 a.m. Please let us know if you have concerns with any of these dates, and audit committee dates are also identified on the calendar. A2B, OPERF investment report. April return showed regular account earnings of negative 0.37%. From a budget execution perspective, the agency has expended 38% of our legislatively approved budget, and at this time, the agency's projected variance is just over $5 million. Item A3, I'll provide an update on board training. And additionally, we have Randy Miller and Rachel Tillman from BoardSmart with us this morning. We'll provide an overview of the BoardSmart online training tool. A4, Matt Rickard will present the Q1 POBMS scores. A5, Debbie Larson will present recommendations for the OSG Advisory Committee appointments. With respect to administrative rulemaking, Stephanie will notice one rule and recommend adoption on three other rules. C1, Yvette will report out on our implementation of Senate Bill 1049. C2, Jake Winship will provide an update on equal to or better than test results to date. Then C3, Jason Stanley will provide a recommendation to expand the role of the audit committee to include risk-related items. C4, Karen Chavez will provide the annual review of the PERS health insurance plan, or PHIP, and then subsequently will then present for board approval the 2023 retiree health insurance plan renewals and rates. And C6, Richard Horsford will present an update on the 23-25 agency budget development. And I believe we will be swapping out C6 and putting that in front of C4 and C5 this morning. That is my report. Pleased to answer any questions on anything I covered off.
Sounds like no questions, Kevin. We can move on to the BoardSmart presentation.
All right. So first I'll do a bit on our board education, training, and policy update. As per my memo to the board, we now, for the last couple of years, have had a board education policy, which is appended. And just wanted to report out, because there actually was some training expenses done. John Scanlon, board member Scanlon, attended the NC PERS Public Pension Forum last year, last August, and there was a cost of $28.79.01. He also just recently attended this year's conference earlier this week. Final costs will be reported in next year's report. And board member Scanlon also attended the trustee education part of that. As I've also noted in my memo, in 2020, we began to subscribe to an online board education tool called BoardSmart. We have Randy Miller and Rachel Tillman here to present the functionality. One of the things that Chair Shinoy and I have talked about is sort of setting up a educational matrix based on that tool. And to that end, there is a proposed onboarding and continuing education matrix based on the different BoardSmart talks, which take anywhere from 30 minutes to 45 minutes apiece to do that. And we recommend that the board look at those and work their way through. We do get regular reports on what the board members can have based on the BoardSmart tool. One other thing that we are building out in the background is our board packet tool, BoardVantage. We are going to be putting in a repository of board-related documents, so you can access it. For instance, we'll be posting our board orientation manual, our funding policy, committee terms of references, links to the Oregon revised statutes, et cetera. So a good update. We had a good year where we're making some progress on making sure we have some good education and governance tools available for the board. I'll take any questions now on what my report stated. Otherwise, we can shift over to Randy and Rachel. If there's no questions, we can turn it over to Randy. I believe you're going to be leading the presentation.
Yes, thank you, Kevin. And it's a pleasure to be here with the PERS board. Thank you very much for providing the time for us to give you an update on BoardSmart. Can you flip to the next slide, please, Kevin? I want to just start by mentioning how we got into BoardSmart and developing BoardSmart. It was really through our Funston Advisory Services organization, where we've worked for the last 12 years exclusively with public retirement systems around governance and operations issues, and have a real commitment to public retirement systems. And what we have seen over the last 12 years is a really consistent need for better governance education. And that's really what led to BoardSmart. Could you go to the next slide, please, Kevin? We view public pensions as really essential and as a win-win for public employees, public employers, and the general public. For employees, for their financial security, for employers to helping to develop and retain the workforce, and for the public for the results of what a qualified workforce can provide to them. Next slide. In the context of PERS, you have major responsibilities as a board for a lot of members and paying benefits from a large asset pool, but there are a lot of uncertainties that challenge both the board and the staff, and it's critical that the board's prepared to fulfill its fiduciary duties and make good decisions, yet you have to be ready to adapt when situations change, and this uncertainty is a key factor in the need for education. Next slide, please. What we see consistently is there's a need for a focus on governance because there is inevitable turnover of trustees. You need stability of direction despite the fact you may have changes in trustees and sometimes staff. You need to develop a clear understanding of what's the role of the board, what are the roles of your staff, what are the roles of your advisors, and that your stakeholders need reassurance that you're fulfilling your duties and that you have the appropriate checks and balances. And effective onboarding and continuing education then is critical because good governance really matters. The next slide, please. To govern has different meanings and different definitions, but it includes to directing and overseeing and ensuring an effective system of control of an organization, achieving the purpose of the organization, prudently exercising your powers. Next slide, please. And that leads to the need for the onboarding and continuing education. As a new trustee, you really don't have a forgiveness period. You're expected to participate in your very first meeting and contribute. So there's a steep learning curve. And sometimes onboarding can be overwhelming. We often see that systems provide a thick binder of materials and maybe spend a half a day or a day with you, walking you through the organization, what the responsibilities are, and so forth. And the continuing education is really critical because it's just an extension of the onboarding, and there are many topics that need periodic updating. But what we see is we like to say one size fits one. While public retirement systems all have more or less the same responsibilities, everyone is different in terms of the governing legislation, their policies, and the way that they serve their members. What we've developed, though, is what we call the enterprise governance framework that we think can help provide a roadmap. And part of the reason for this discussion with you today is we've reorganized. If you've had some experience with BoardSmart, we're in the process of reorganizing it into fit the enterprise governance framework. And we think this will help put a context for the educational program that's available within BoardSmart, and also can help to make it more specific to your jurisdiction and system, and to develop the individualized plans that I think Kevin referred to earlier. The next slide, please. So the purpose of a public retirement system is to be sustainable in creation and delivering of the benefits for all current and future members, despite all the uncertainties, and to continue to provide the vital functions. The vital functions can vary from one system to another. For PERS, those include providing the retirement benefits as well as post-retirement health care and the general administration of the system. Next slide, please. And your fiduciary duties as a board are pretty well defined, they're really, you're held to the highest legal standard, more so than corporate directors, because there's such a potential for conflict. One of those, as you see on the left side, one of the key fiduciary duties is to stay informed. And of course, that links in directly to continuing education and where BoardSmart fits in. Next slide. I mentioned the potential for conflicts of interest, and that's a key aspect of fiduciary duties, to be keenly aware that you have to be act impartially, ensure that decisions are only in the best interests of all members and beneficiaries. Knowing who and how to trust can be very important in being able to do that. Next slide, please. And some of the governance challenges for lay boards, and we make the distinction of lay boards versus expert boards, is that the trustees are part-time, you're not compensated for your service, but sometimes you have to make unpopular decisions. Your board meetings are public, which can make open discussion uncomfortable at times. Usually no one individual trustee has expertise in all of the areas that are necessary. And often there's criticism of non-expert boards, but one study at least has shown that expert boards don't necessarily perform better, but that retirement systems need to have capable resources and technologies to be effective, yet often you don't have the authority to approve all of the resources necessary. We believe that despite all of these constraints, despite the fact that you may have a lay board, the best solution is effective education combined with the expert advice that you get from your advisors and staff that can help prepare boards for whatever decisions they need to make. Next slide. So in terms of acquiring the expertise and experience necessary for board development, we see seven questions to ask to make sure that you're getting adequate fiduciary development. One is, do you have access to the expertise that you need in terms of your advisors and your staff? Do you have continuing education? Is everyone aware of the key questions to ask and why to ask them? Do you have constructive challenge in your meetings? Do you gain insight from the information you get? Typically, boards get an overwhelming amount of information, but can you distill them down and to get the insight? And can you be certain that you've got the verification of the reports that you need, and are the reports reliable? Next slide, please. I mentioned the enterprise governance framework, so that all leads us to what we've developed here. And I'm going to just walk you through this, what we call our placemat or our wall chart, to try to get the framework on one page. It meant to be a visual reminder and a basis for navigation. And the reason to go through this with you is this is the new organization for the talks in BoardSmart. The challenges and uncertainties of a 21st century cannot be so nicely contained in the rectangles that we're attempting to depict here. It's really a mass of global circumstances of seemingly unrelated events and conditions and perceptions, which forces a board to make difficult choices about the direction of the system and their oversight and having an effective system of control on something that has long-term consequences for thousands of people and billions of dollars. But we hope that we've developed a better way to organize these duties and the purpose and the powers and put them in context. So the statutes are organized numerically and usually not categorically, and so it can make it difficult to understand. And system policies are often organized relatively idiosyncratically without the benefit of an organizing framework. And this is meant to be the organizing framework for both the statutes and the policies. And we hope that this will provide benefits of providing a simpler context for
the duties and responsibilities and improving the clarity of roles, authorities, and accountabilities, and help to accelerate the learning curve, particularly for newer trustees, and provide a common language and above governance and engagement. Next slide, please. So focusing particularly on the powers reserved in that governance framework, we talk about conducting the business, setting direction and then delegating, approving decisions, overseeing execution, and then verifying, but then trust. And for some examples, when we talk about conduct, we mean things like the board meetings, the executive director evaluation, board self-assessment, continuing education, hiring board advisors, the things that the board really has to conduct themselves. And then setting and delegating, there are things like actuarial assumptions, IT strategy, funding strategy, the things that they're key decisions that typically are taken over a period of months where you have deliberations and then reach a decision on setting a strategy and then delegating execution of that strategy. Approving key decisions are decisions like annual budgets, major contracts, approving financial statements. Typically they're recurring. They don't have the same level of due diligence that setting and delegating have. And then overseeing, which is what we see boards typically spend most of their time on, overseeing execution of direction within policy. These can be regular reviews of performance, obtaining exception reports, program reviews, that type of thing, where it's more of an ongoing monitoring and providing feedback. And then verification and trust is we're reviewing of audit reports, potentially commissioning independent reviews and so forth, provided by internal audit, external audit, other providers, as well as your independent advisors. And the role of the executive director and staff then is to execute the policy that you set and the delegation of those powers to staff, acting on behalf of the board, reporting back to you and advising the board as well. And then, as I mentioned, the board has auditors and advisors who are independent of management that provide the reassurance to the board that they can rely on management's reports. So this is a key element of the enterprise governance framework that encompasses, you know, most of what the board needs to do. And that's what we have been reorganizing BoardSmart into this framework. Next slide, please. So over the next month, as we roll out what we're calling version 2.0 of BoardSmart, we will have the enterprise governance framework, that one pager configured for PERS with your logo and mission statement on it and a placemat as a reminder. And then you'll be able to look into the BoardSmart system and find the existing talks organized into that framework. And then that will support development of your onboarding and continuing education plan that you'll develop with staff. And with that, hopefully that was helpful in putting a context around kind of the new version of BoardSmart. But we'll entertain any questions.
Randy, Kevin here. Just a question on the timing of this being set up so that when the board members do access BoardSmart, they know it's new format and it's not the old version 1.0.
Yes, and I'll turn that over to Rachel, our Chief Content Officer. She's been working directly with our technology folks and getting that taken care of.
Rachel? Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me. So we're going to be launching the version 2.0 on June 3rd. That's the projected date. So we will be offline for a couple of days leading up to that, but the new version will be available on June 3rd.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Sadhana Shenoy. I just had a comment that it's only very recently that the PERS board has adopted a formal board education policy. In fact, it was just in 2020, and at the right time, because of COVID, we were not able to interact with as many people in our universe as we normally would have liked to. So I just wanted to say that the learning modules in BoardSmart, the ones that I have taken, I think are going to be a very valuable part of our board education process. So I very much look forward to version two, and I very much look forward to working with both of you.
Great. Thank you very much. And we appreciate that kind of feedback, and also any specific feedback you may have. If you think there are topics that we should be addressing, we're really pleased to get that kind of input to on what we should be working on that would be of more value to you as well. If you think we have some gaps, we're always developing additional content.
Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. Hearing no other questions, I wanted to thank Mr. Miller and Rachel Tillman for coming and presenting us with this, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you. And likewise from our side as well. We appreciate you as a client. Thank you.
Kevin, any comments before we move on?
Just no. As I said, within the board packet, there's the continuing education plan that I've sort of tried to scope out based on what version 2.0 is and what I believe would be sort of recommended trainings and what I believe would be optional training. So it gives the board a chance to take a look at them and sort of work their way through these, because I think it is important. They're very insightful. I went through these all, took all of them to make sure that they were relevant to what we do as compared to some who have both the asset and the liability side of the pension equation, responsibilities, et cetera. So it's a start, and we'll continue to refine them as time goes on.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you once again. Moving right along, the next item is a board scorecard report on the agency performance measures. Matt Rickard.
Great. Thank you, Chair Shenoy and members of the board. For the record, I'm Matt Rickards, the Central Data Coordinator, and on behalf of the PERS Outcome-Based Management System Council, I'm presenting the board scorecard report for you today, and this highlights a key selection of measures from our agency enterprise-level scorecards. But before I get into the performance results for this quarter, I wanted to share about a current engagement of our POBMS Council. So based on questions and directions from the board during my last board presentation in December, the POBMS Council is undertaking an effort to review our enterprise measures that have been consistently underperforming versus the current targets. So the intent is to work with our measure owners to update the targets, ranges, and measurement criteria for these measures to make the goals more realizable. While we're still in the early stages of this effort, we have made changes to four of the measures to date, and others, several others remain under review. Now, some of the changes have been minor, like consolidating two of our HR measures to reflect the replacement of employee reviews and goals with the current practice of quarterly employee check-ins, and updating our public records response time measure to reflect recent public records request rule changes. But a more substantial measure change was accomplished with one of the measures on our board scorecard, and that's call wait time. Now, before this, the target had been set at 2 minutes, with a green range at less than 4 minutes, a yellow range between 4 to 6, and a red range at greater than 6 minutes. And despite great efforts on the part of our call center, the performance had not been out of that red range in over 3 years, and it hadn't hit that green level in the past 6 years, amidst an environment of rising call volumes over the span of this measure. So the council worked with our measure owner, call center manager Melissa Pazanka, to draft and approve new goals for this measure. So the new approved target is now set at 10 minutes. Green range is at anything less than 12. The yellow range is between 12 to 15, and a red range is anything that's greater than 15 minutes. And our recruitment measure on the board scorecard was also involved in this effort, but a decision was made to further review the changing circumstances before making any substantial changes to the measure. So the POBMS Council will continue working with measure owners over the coming months to complete this measure review and update process, and we'll certainly keep you posted of that. So getting back to the performance on our board scorecard, what we're covering today is performance during the first quarter of 2022, and I'll just share a few of those highlights and key takeaways with you. So we experienced a slight decrease in the overall outcome and process measure performance with this report. In your board materials, the pie chart reflects 36 measures that were in the green range, with 15 in the yellow and 15 in the red. This is fewer than the 41 green measures that we had in the last board report. And the quarterly green performance chart reflects 54% of our measures in the green ranges, which is slightly lower than the 56% during the last report. As for the individual measures on this report, we do have 4 of the 8 measures that are performing in those green ranges. And there have been 8 consecutive quarters in the green range for both estimates and eligibility reviews completed, and we've had 5 consecutive quarters in the green range for accuracy of calculations. Now, while we've experienced these positive performances, there were also 3 of the measures performing in the red and yellow ranges, and one of the measures that's missing data due to a technical issue with a data collection tool. And to help add some context around these red and yellow performances, I just wanted to provide a few details and mitigating factors for you. So with our call wait time measure, this quarter included extremely high call volume. In fact, in the month of March, we experienced the second highest monthly call volume in the history of our call center, and that was 20,413 calls just for that 1 month alone. And for the quarter, we received nearly 50,000 calls for the entire quarter. That's about 9,200 more than the previous quarter. And it's about 500 more than last year at this time. And with our recruitment efforts, the 8-week timeframe for this measure remains challenging to meet. Under the current market and employment environment, we've experienced many declined offers. So our executive leadership team approved a minor change to reflect closing and restarting the recruitment process if an offer is not accepted and there is no acceptable backup candidate. So in this way, we wouldn't penalize ourselves in this measure if those declined offers occur. And then lastly, our system downtime was impacted by regular expected long batch runs that accounted for about 87% of the total downtime for the quarter. And then some of the other downtime was mitigated by moving impacted servers to the state data center. So the next board scorecard report will be presented at the December 2022 board meeting, and that will cover results for the third quarter of 2022. And so that's my summary in a nutshell. Do we have any questions or comments today from the board?
Matt,
yeah,
this is
go ahead. Yeah, this is board member Scanlon. What are there some ideas about, other than hiring more people, are there other ideas that you're floating around on the call wait time? Are you looking at some other solutions on that? Yeah, and one thing that I've discovered is, my background was a K-12 teacher, and we would have to deal with TSPC, and that was always a problem they struggled with as well quite often. I don't know if they've gone to this, but I know some companies have gone to the leave your name, we'll call you back when it's your turn kind of thing, which I've always found more convenient than hanging on listening to music. So if you can comment on that.
Yes, certainly. Chair Shenoy and Board Member Scanlon, what you're saying is true. Staffing is one of the major issues. The high call volume is of course the biggest. Usually for a call center of our size, the typical volume is going to be between 12 to 15,000 calls a month. And so we're fielding a lot more calls than our average, similarly staffed, call center. And we were also, for this quarter, we were down a couple of our RC1, our retirement counselor 1 positions. So that impacted things. But you're also correct about the callback feature. We have a service provider called Phonalo, that provides this service for us. And I, my guess is that the call wait time would be more severe had it not been for that feature. And of course, the take up rate impacts that, like how many callers take advantage of that feature would certainly mitigate that, because we're, you know, it's up to them. It's whether they hold or accept that feature or take advantage of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Matt, this is Sadhna Shenoy. So what you're saying is that when I call into the PERS phone line, I have the option of leaving my phone number and having PERS return my call when they have the staff. Is that what Phonolo does?
Yeah, Chair Shenoy, that is correct. I think if you were to call in and happen to reach a live agent right at that time, obviously that would not come into play. But if you were in that queue and you're on hold, you do have that option. I believe I've never tried it myself, but I think, the Phonolo system kind of comes on and it asks you if you would like to be called back when the call agent comes on, and it just calls your phone, and there's usually a few seconds or whatnot for the call agent to come on and they pick up.
So these 22.4 minute waiting time is for people who choose not to avail of this service and choose to stay on the line instead?
Chair Shenoy, that's correct. I think probably like their initial call, if they were to wait on hold for a time and then kind of change their mind, I don't know if it comes on periodically or not, you know, like that would certainly come into play on that 22.4 minutes, but not for the time that they're not being called. Like if they've taken advantage of Phonolo and they're just sitting at home or doing whatever, that's not going to be included in that time frame.
Okay. Well, certainly this is From where I sit, this is a cause for concern. I don't like to see somebody having to wait for 22 minutes, but having Phonolo in place is partially mitigating, because, you know, you don't have to wait and listen to music. Like Director Scanlon said, you can do your own business. So that is good. I think we'll continue to monitor this particular measure. And I think every time Director Olenek and I speak, this sort of is brought up. So I'm going to continue to keep bothering him about this, and then by definition bother you about it. So
that's good.
Yeah. So good luck with bringing this under control. And I'm sure as PERS is embarking on its modernization schedule, this will also improve, because, you know, there's a lot of background that has to keep functioning for swift responses to queries. So.
Yes. Yeah. Director Olenek, just sort of interjecting a bit on that. And there's two components to it. One is the call wait time, and then one is our average handle time. And given that we have a very disparate system where staff might have to go to multiple systems and open in multiple screens, that slows down our average wait time or our average handle time. So as we move to modernize and build out a client relationship management tool, a CRM tool, where it's sort of a single source of truth that our member information center staff can access quickly, efficiently, that will slow or get our call average waiting or average hold or handling time. Sorry. It will compress that, which then allows us to take more calls. So, there's multiple benefits of moving forward with modernization and having a CRM tool in place. So we're hoping that we can get the funding over the next biennium or so to start to implement that so that we can provide better service. One thing I could add to this too is, while the average wait times are not great by any stretch of the imagination, we do get some very strong member comments with respect to when I do get a chance to talk to somebody, they're very satisfied. So the satisfaction rate and first call resolution once we get to them is quite high. So it balances that out a bit too.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for mentioning that. I will say the average quality score that we receive, these are official reviews and surveys amongst our callers, is 98%. So these folks are extremely satisfied. We also, I will just add for the benefit of this discussion, we received an award this quarter from our callback provider. I guess all of this different call centers who use this feature are put into this queue, and two centers are awarded each year for quality of service, and PERS was one of those call centers this time. So that's noteworthy.
Yeah. Thank you. I do also want to mention that the other measure that we have been watching is the timely benefit calculation, and I'm really happy to see a huge progress in that 98.8% measure, score on that measure. And so that's very nice. Thank you so much for that, for the effort on that.
Thank you, Chair Shinoy.
And the board certainly hopes that all of these are reflected in the CEM result that we see in July. So fingers crossed on that.
Yes.
That's my baby too.
Anything else from the board? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Matt, for your report.
Thank you.
Kevin, shall we move on to the next item?
Yes.
Okay. A5 is the OSGP committee appointment, Debbie Larson.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Shinoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, and members of the board. For the record, my name is Debbie Larson, OSGP Program Manager. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. As you know, OSGP has a 7-member advisory committee. All 7 positions expire on June 30th of this year. We are seeking reappointment of 6 of those positions. The 7th committee member is not interested in reappointment, and we have not yet received interest to fill that local government seat. We will continue to recruit to fill that vacancy. Today, I'm asking for your approval to reappoint Colin Benson from the Department of Justice to start a second full term, Eugene Bentley, a retiree from state service, to start a second full term, Christine Valentine from the Oregon State Board of Geologist Examiners to start a second full term, Kyle Nehmeyer, from Oregon State University to start a first full term after completing his current partial term, Jeff Gibbs from Gresham Barlow School District to start a first full term after completing his current partial term, and lastly, Zechariah Heck from the Oregon Department of Transportation to start a first full term after completing his current partial term. So with that, I ask the board to consider reappointing the 6 members to begin July 1st and end June 30th, 2025. Any questions?
Hearing none, do I hear interest in moving this from the board?
This is Stephen Buckley. I move that the board appoint the 6 individuals to the advisory committee for the Oregon Savings Growth Plan as detailed in the agenda material.
This is John Scanlon. I second.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shinoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jardon Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you. So moved.
Thank you.
Debbie, I had a question. So this board has 7 members. So where is the 7th going to come from?
Thank you for the question, Chair Shinoy. The 7th member will be a local government member. And we thought we had some interest, but it didn't go through. So we're continuing to work with our local governments to see if we can fill that vacancy.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving right along, we are at the administrative rulemaking section of our agenda. Stephanie Wan.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy, Vice Chair Fernstall. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. We'll kick off at item B1, which is notice of our contested case hearing rule. And we've edited this rule to add the board's delegation of final order signing to the executive director of PERS. The board delegated this authority back in 2008, but it's never been put into rule. It's not been required to be in rule. We're doing this for transparency purposes at this point. But as we were looking through the rule, we also recognized that there is no contingency for circumstances under which the board or the executive director may not be available. So staff is recommending additional delegation of authority. Staff evaluated a couple of different options and is recommending the delegating of the authority to the director as well as the deputy director. The rule is edited to incorporate this change as well, and unless the board directs otherwise, we will move forward with that particular change. The rule was also amended to reflect that the board may review final orders in any format, whether that's a board meeting or electronically or by phone. The rule previously stated that the board would generally review rules or review orders in a public meeting. That is not our current practice. So we have amended the rule to reflect that the board may review those orders in any format. This is notice only, so there's no action required at this time. And we do anticipate bringing these forward at the next board meeting, which is July board meeting. Right. Item B2 is adoption of our death and survivor benefits rule. As a quick reminder, the edits to this rule specify or clarify when beneficiary designations that members put on their retirement applications take effect. It also clarifies how outstanding invoices are handled when we are paying out a death benefit or making a payout on death of a retired member. We received no changes or received no public comment on the rule, and we've made no changes to the rule since notice. So we are seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
Do I hear a motion to adopt this rule?
This is Board Member Jaramillo. So moved.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. Those in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you, everyone. So moved.
Thank you. Moving on to item B3 is adoption of our employer incentive rule. This rule has been amended to extend the window for the first application cycle to March 31st of 2023. The reason for this is to allow a recent influx of funds from the 2022 legislature to be applied to employers that were waitlisted with the first application cycle due to the pulling back of some of that original funding. This rule, the edits also specify that the extension is specifically for waitlisted employers, so we're not taking any new applications for those funds. And we've heard from most of the employers that were waitlisted, and so far all of them are wanting to participate in this additional funding. So we've made no changes to the rules since notice, and we've received no public comments. So we are seeking a motion to adopt the rules as presented.
If there are no questions of Stephanie, is there interest in moving?
This is Stephen Buckley. I make a motion that the board adopt the Employer Incentive Fund Program rule as presented in the agenda packet.
This is Board Member Jaramillo, second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you all. So moved.
Thank you. And finally, item B4 is adoption of the employee status rule. This rule has been on our agenda for a while. It is the implementation of Senate Bill 112 from the 2021 session, and we convened a work group to work on the rule, and when we were ready to bring it forward, when we thought we were ready to bring it forward originally, we had some comment from individuals of the work group wanting to continue those discussions and further review the rule, which we did. We worked with the work group between February and April of this year. We have made amendments to the rule or to the rule from the original submission. We edited the rule to remove a definition of non-employee. Excuse me. And in removing that definition, we removed the use of that word throughout the entire rule. So that required some other edits to make things make sense. And we added to the list of records that an individual may submit to PERS to support their position, noting that the list in the rule is not all inclusive. It just lists very common things, but we did add to that list that of documentation that they can provide. And we clarified that the presumption that we're making in the rule is specific with regard to the participating employer. Previously, it was general to whether it was whether they were an employee of the participating employer or a third party employer. And what we are focusing on and what we care about is whether they're an employee of the participating public employer. So we have edited the rule to be specific to that status only. We worked through these edits with the work group, and we are bringing the rule forward now for adoption, incorporating all of those edits that have been approved by the work group.
Well, Stephanie, this is Sadhana Shenoy. All of the comments and concerns of the work group have been addressed and incorporated to their satisfaction?
Chair Shenoy, yes, that's correct. Yes.
And is that why we needed the second public comment period?
Correct. Yes. The given that we weren't able to meet or reconvene the work group right away with a short legislative session in 2022, it took us a while to get those meetings scheduled with the work group so that we could have everybody participating in that discussion.
Thank you. If there are no questions from board members, is there any interest in this motion?
This is Stephen Buckley. I make a motion that the board adopt the rules to implement Senate Bill 112 as detailed in the agenda packet.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jardon Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you, everyone. So moved.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie. Moving right along, item C1, which is SB 1049 implementation discussion and update by Yvette.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. It's nice to see most of you in person today. I'm here to present the update for Senate Bill 1049 implementation. Overall, the program and projects are going very well. You'll see that the two main projects that we have going right now, member redirect and technical debt, are both in user acceptance testing. And the results today are that we're at 86% tested and passed, so that is going very well. For the program health, we, as you know, remain at yellow because we need to request funds in the next biennium. So we have started the budget request process for those funds to continue the project and hopefully conclude in the midway through that biennium. We do have a cross-project effort going on that is a lot of our desktop user applications. They're kind of offline. And those tools are also in user acceptance testing, and two of them have already completed and been deployed. So that's going very well. But that little project, that smaller project, is red because we have one tool that remains very challenging for us to deploy. We're trying to use a new platform, and it's just we're working with Microsoft to remove blockers in that area. Overall, all of the program and project activities are normal. As we've been reporting, all of our independent quality management services, those reports been going very well. We don't really have any red statuses for any of their recommendations and that sort of thing. The biggest thing going on right now is our annual statements are being mailed, and they do contain the new EPSA component on that. So we know if members weren't paying attention last year when we mailed them, that they, because they might have stuck them in a drawer and not open them. If they do open them this year, they may have questions, also increasing our phone call volume. And that is one of the biggest triggers at this time of the year for calls. If you, that completes my report. If you have any questions, I'm available.
Yeah, this is board member John Scanlon. Can you speak a little bit to the EPSA component and you know, to what extent that's, you know, is going to be of interest to, you know, a future retiree? If you could kind of define it maybe a little bit and explain, you know, speak to why that's important to have that on the report.
Okay. Chair Shenoy, board member Scanlon, the employee pension stability account was put in place to start having members contribute to a portion of their pension. And so that account is created to start funding it prospectively. And at the time of retirement, of a distribution or retirement, the staff look at that account, and they right now are manually calculating it, but see how that funds that. And if there's any excess, the member will get the excess dollar amount, account balance. And so that's why we're being very transparent about what is in that account, so that there would be a portion that would fund the retirement. And it's just the prospective amount that our prospective retirement credit that it's funding. And then they would get a refund of the excess dollars, excess contributions. So right now for tier one and tier two, it's 2.5% of their 6% contributions. And for OPSERP, it's 0.75% of their member contributions going into that account.
Okay, so a follow-up question. So what would create an excess contribution? My understanding is the 2.5% goes in there and it's gone and we never see it again, as from a employee perspective. Mm-hmm. What would create such a situation that at the end you'd say, oh wait, there's too much? Other than a clerical error along the way, or?
Chair Shenoy, board member Scanlon, that's a great question. I don't know if I can technically answer what would create an excess, since I haven't actually done those calculations myself. But I don't know if Director Olenek can answer that.
Sorry, I cannot.
Perhaps that's a great question. Scott, we can find out. We could find out and let the board know.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. I had a question about the cross-project effort. So it is in red because of the addition of a new tool that is being worked on?
Yeah, Chair Shenoy, we have only a few tools left in that project, having deployed two of the larger ones just recently. So the remaining, or work package 6, is called an IAP balance comparison tool. It's a brand new tool. All the other tools that we have been working on already existed, and so they just had to make some updates to those to bring in target date funds or member choice or work after retirement, whatever the case may be. Most of these tools have to do with IAP, because as you may be aware of, we have Voya, who manages all of the employee contributions, and we have PERS, who are employers' data comes through PERS, goes to Voya, and we're basically managing two systems. And so this new tool was to compare those systems so we could proactively
reconcile any discrepancies. Right now, it's kind of a just-in-time model. If the member applies for retirement or a distribution through the IAP, or withdrawal, we compare and adjust if we see a discrepancy. We do not have the ability to look at all member accounts, and there are about 265,000 of them. I don't even know if I got that right, but I know it's in those numbers.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah. And so you're just working on trying to figure it out, and
We're working on using newer functionality through Microsoft 365. It's called Power Apps. And our operation technical section team hadn't used that before. So they are working with Microsoft, getting training and troubleshooting environments. I mean, it's very technical, but they are now looking at how to bring in using this new platform and also develop this new tool. So we want to, it's kind of a gap until we can bring the individual account program in-house.
Yeah, great. After successfully implementing the majority of the program, now this is the long tail that just doesn't seem to get done. So.
Yes, just Chair Shinoy, one final thing. The fact that this tool is red, we did not feel needed to bring the whole program red because this is a standalone tool. None of the other work packages are dependent on it. And so that was one reason why we didn't move the program to red.
Yeah, understood. Thank you. Thank you, Yvette.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much. Next item, C2 equal to or better than testing update, Jake Winship.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Jake Winship. I'm the manager of the actuarial activities section. And if you will note in the board packet, there are two documents that are related to equal to or better than testing. The first is a memo that I wrote. And really to summarize, this is a process that we are required by statute to perform at least every 12 years for public safety plans that are not part of PERS. They're allowed to be exempt if we can determine that the benefits provided to their members are equal to or better than those that they've received were they part of PERS. So that process is ongoing. We're working with Independent Actuaries Incorporated, and they have completed their first phase of assessment. As we discussed earlier, basically that's comparing point by point the benefits that they would receive under PERS. And if it's a defined benefit program, then we can have a direct comparison. Obviously, if the direct defined benefit provided by that plan are the same or better than what PERS has, they've met the requirements. So initially, 5 of the 9 plans were eligible for that assessment. And we did determine, since the memo originally came out, that 4 of the 5 unambiguously passed that phase 1. And those are the City of Forest Grove, the City of Portland, Morrow County, and then as well Tillamook County also passed that assessment. And that's actually an improvement from the last equal to or better than determination when we employed a similar two-phase plan where only 3 of the 5 were able to pass in the initial plan. So we will continue to look at City of Seaside, which is a defined benefit plan, and it will move on to phase 2 as well as the other 4 plans, 3 of those being defined contribution plans. That's City of the Dalles, Union County, and Wheeler County. And then the City of Springfield is a cash balance plan. Legally, it's a defined benefit plan, but its structure is such that it looks like a defined contribution plan. I did want to take a moment here to, since we have a couple of the people present, when Mercer did the original determination, they had a great deal of struggle determining what the requirements actually were. and they were of immense aid in this process with the policies and procedures and administrative rules that were put in place. They've made this process much smoother than we feared it might be. And the present state, it's looking really hopeful. We appear to be ahead of schedule, and there seem to be no obstacles to completing this determination by next board meeting in July. And just many of the items that I mentioned in the memo are discussed in greater detail in the presentation that Aaron Reardon, who's actually the actuary performing the determination, he put that together, has a lot of good detail if you care to look at that. And then finally, the last point I want to touch upon before there are any questions, we did change the previous determination, used the then current assumed rate of 8% that has been reduced in the assumptions a number of times. It's currently 6.9%, and that's what's used going forward. One of the not necessarily intended side effects of that is it makes a defined benefit plan look inherently more attractive than a defined contribution plan. Basically, what that means is because you're discounting future defined benefits at a lower discount rate, that makes the present value higher. So if you have $100,000 in 10 years, it will have a higher present value if you discount it at 5% rather than 10%. So it's sort of an artifact. We do believe that the assumed rates are our best estimate going forward, but the defined contribution rates don't have that benefit. So the relative attractiveness, you know, does change just based on that factor. That's kind of a technical assessment that's not necessarily related to the underlying benefit provided to the member. However, there's only one plan currently that looks that it might need remedial action, which is good. And we believe that all the information is necessary to complete the determination in plenty of time for the next board meeting. So I welcome any questions the board may have at this point.
Mr. Winship, this is Steve Buckley. I have two questions. First question is, do you expect to have a representative from Independent Actuaries at the July meeting to summarize its findings?
Board Member Buckley. I have spoken to Mr. Reardon on this topic. It is our understanding that the board does not necessarily need for him to appear, but he is willing and able to do so if that's desired by the board.
Okay. Second question is that perhaps you may ask the board to conclude that four of the plans are in fact equal to or better than PERS at today's meeting. Have you received the necessary reports and backup information from independent actuaries to draw that conclusion, or have you just received the kind of a conclusionary information?
I have received the conclusionary information. So in answer to your question, no, I haven't received the final report for that. And actually, that's a good context for this. There have been subsequent discussions after the board materials were prepared, and we are not requesting any board motion today. We don't feel that interim board action is necessary to move forward, and we'll just anticipate board approval when all the final reports are presented.
And then would you expect or request some kind of a detailed report from independent actuaries to back up their conclusion for each employer in the event there's a challenge from one of the participants in one of these programs?
Yes, we do anticipate that they will provide a full report with documentation, very much modeled on the previous report provided by Mercer, so that has been detailed and specified as part of their contract of work.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Any further questions?
Quick question, and I know that this is looking way further ahead than we need to at today's meeting, but what are the remedy options that are available? Are they also identified in the IAI report, or is that something we need to look at ourselves?
Thank you, Chair Shinoy. We are looking into that. We've had very preliminary discussions, and we need to determine what the administrative rule and the statute. I believe the statute is silent upon remedies because we have discussed numerous options. One of them would be to force the plan or to force the members to become part of PERS. Based on precedent from the prior determination, there were at least two plans that failed to meet equal to or better determination initially. They were allowed to enhance their benefits in such a way that they did satisfy, and I believe they formally repetitioned as part of that process. However, as that becomes more salient, PERS staff, as well at, in consultation with independent actuaries, will meet with PERS legal team and really determine what is required by the rules. And but I anticipate, should that occur, part of independent actuaries' final report will be proposed remedial action that would bring them in line with the equal to or better than requirements.
Okay. Thank you. So at the next board meeting, we will have the final report from IAI.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next item, C3, is Audit and Risk Committee Oversight, Jason Stanley.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. Good to see you again. For the record, Jason Stanley, Chief Compliance Audit and Risk Officer. So I'm coming before you today with a memo, item C3, proposing to expand the function of the audit committee to include other areas of risk. In this last year, we have presented other areas of risk, information security and continuity management, and it seemed to be an appropriate venue to share those areas. We have been working on formalizing our programs, and in 2019, we established industry standard programs in both of those areas, information security and continuity. They continue to mature, continue to work on those, and we feel it's appropriate for the committee to also get regular updates in that area. This would include changing our charter slightly to include those other areas, and we would be doing that assuming the board approves such a change. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I see head nods.
There's some quick question. This is Sadhana Shivari. So Shane Perry in your team represents the IT expertise if the risk program were to go under your department?
Shane Perry, yeah, he oversees our security and risk section. So he would oversee the both the continuity and the information security sections. And hopefully one day enterprise risk management as well. But as you know, that's still, yes. We don't have that quite yet, but fingers crossed for the next session.
So we have discussed this at the audit meeting, but if any of the other board members have any questions of Jason? It's all yours, Jason. No questions.
Okay.
We're looking for a motion, Chair Shinoy.
Motion.
Yeah, yes. I'm waiting for Jason to ask that.
This is Board Member Jaramillo. I move to expand the oversight of the PERS Audit Committee to include other areas of risk, and the committee will now be known as the PERS Audit and Risk Committee.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jardon Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Very good. Thank you. So thank moved.
You. Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we are going to work on item C6. We are moving that up a little bit. The 23-25 agency budget update, Richard Hosford.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Richard Horsford, Chief Financial Officer. Today I'm giving you an update on the status of our 2023-25 agency budget development. Since the last time we met, staff has been diligently working through the potential business cases and budget for the 23-25 year. At this point in time, per the memo, we have three major categories of asks, one being the shoring up of current operations. At this point, those as a whole look like about $2.4 million and represent 12 FTE. That is notably less than the last time, about $1.8 million less than last time we met. The main reasoning is that those we've been able to trim back some of the FTEs, as well as identifying areas where we could offset some of the costs by reductions of costs. So in that the current operations portion, that would represent an increase of under 2% of our current service level. The next major category, Senate Bill 1049 related items, that remains unchanged from the last time that we spoke, which would be about $16.5 million, representing 29 FTE. We do expect that to be in the neighborhood of 9 permanent FTEs that would be needed to manage the increased complexities of systems on an ongoing basis, and about 20 FTEs to finish the Senate Bill 1049 project to completion. The last major category, which still is listed as to be determined, is the modernization project. We do have an e-board request that is being heard to provide more funding for the current biennium. That e-board meets next week. And based on the results of that, I think we'll have much more clarity on what the full ask of modernization is, but we do know this will be a very significant ask that has been brewing for a number of years. So hopefully, as soon as we get a little more clarity, we'll be able to nail down some more distinct numbers on that. All in all, I think that gives a good summary of where we're at in the development, and we're hoping to wrap things up fairly soon. I would entertain any questions or be willing to dig into more detail of some of the particular asks if anyone would like.
So you'll bring the final budget to us at the next meeting, July meeting?
Yes, that is true. That is correct.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Chair Shenoy?
Mm-hmm.
This is Lawrence Hartsdall.
Yes.
If we're done with that item, while my employer OHSU does not have ownership interest in any of the health plans that are referenced in the next two items, we do have contractual relationships with them. So to avoid any appearance of conflict, I will recuse myself from these two final items and appreciate them being put at the end of the agenda. So it was good to see everyone.
Thank you, Director Fernstall. We can move on to the next item now. First, E-HIP.
Good to see you.
Kevin Chavez.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy and members of the board. For the record, I'm Karen Chavez,
the PERS Health Insurance Program Manager. I'm pleased to speak with you this morning about the Health Insurance Program 2021 Annual Report. Next, please. As you know, PHIP is a post-retirement service program offered by PERS. It was established in the 1950s, and over time, it's grown and changed as retiree needs and expectations have changed, as well as policy and the industry itself. PERS retirees have a choice when it comes to purchasing health insurance, and that choice is dependent upon drivers, including cost, coverage, relationship to their providers, as well as experience with insurance carriers. So we recognize that our members pay for their premiums from a fixed income, and stability allows members to plan for meeting their medical needs and the associated costs. We also know that changes in health coverage in providers can be a significant disruption to our members. This is why our PHIP mission and our core values focus on providing stability in these three areas. Next, please. In addition to our mission and values, we administer the program based on a set of fundamental operating principles that focus on the equitable benefit plans and costs across all of our contracted health plans or CHPs, and understanding that members have a choice and being competitive with the commercial market. We want to exceed industry quality standards and be innovative, as well as advocate for our enrollees in both coverage and cost. We also want to provide excellent customer service. Next, please. Programmatically, in addition to mission values and our principles, we do have a governance structure that includes all of the standard Oregon revised statutes, OARs, PHIP missions and values. Again, PERS board, we have a voluntary advisory committee, and we also fall under the guidelines for CMS, or the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. These federal state rules, regulations, and help us maintain our timelines and manage our impacts. Next, please. The PERS team that's dedicated to administering the program includes Danielle Kaiser, who's been with our program for about 12 years, Carla Shaw, who's been with us for two, Paul Smith, who is currently on a job rotation for the past 22 months, and I've been the program manager for almost 4 years. In addition to our PHIP staff, we have some key PERS partners that are vital to the day-to-day operations, including Roseanne Lurie, who is the PHIP accountant, and Abigail Churchill, who is our procurement specialist. We have a variety of other partners across the organization, as you can see from this list, that enable us to provide timely and coordinated services to PERS retirees. Next, please. In addition to the PHIP team, essential to our daily operations are two critical contracts. Our third-party administrator is currently Benefit Help Solutions, and they provide direct service to our members, including a dedicated call center, member account services, member claims accounting, record keeping, as well as reporting services. We provide oversight to those processes to assure that correct payments, audit trails, et cetera, and member needs are met. Another essential contract for us is our health insurance consultant. This year, we're welcoming Siegel Consulting into this role. They help us understand the complexities of Medicare, industry-wide practices, as well as changes and movements within the marketplace. They advise us on strategies and plan design to help us remain competitive. They compile and analyze financial and utilization data, present trends, and help us assess benefits, and they're critical to our annual rate renewal process. Next, please. PHIP contracts with six contracted health plans, or CHPs. They provide Medicare, non-Medicare, and dental benefits. All of our medical plans also include a prescription drug plan, or a PDP. Many of our CHPs have been providing coverage to our PHIP members for decades. These long-term relationships have led to collaborative understandings about the program mission and values and a commitment to the PHIP operating principles. You can see from this list here, we have three listed on this page. We have six. There's too many to put on one slide. So here we have Kaiser, Moda, and Delta Dental Plan of Oregon. Next, please. Additionally, we see Pacific Source, Providence, and United Healthcare. Having these six CHPs gives members a large pool to choose from or in to maintain the relationships with their doctors and clinics. It allows for continuity of care between non-Medicare and Medicare plans, and it also allows our members to seek insurance coverage both at the local level and nationwide. Next, please, Kevin. PHIP program membership is defined in ORS 238410 as PERS retirees, their spouses, and dependents who meet the criteria outlined in that in the ORS. As of December 2021, PHIP membership consisted of more than 46,000 retirees, about 10,000 spouses, and 240 dependents for a total membership of 56,240. This is down from last year's total of 57,540, which is about a decrease of 1,300 members. Next, please. The average age for PHIP members remains at 76 years old. Across the populations, that average didn't change, except in the COBRA population, which moved from 37 years of age to 46 years old. That's likely due to this very small COBRA population that we serve. As of the end of April, we had a member age range from 6 years old to 109 years old, with 94 of our members being 100 years or older. Next, please. On membership trends, on these charts, you can see this decrease in 1,300 member accounts pretty readily. The non-Medicare line looks a little bit more dramatic than the Medicare trend line, but that's due to the difference in scale on the left-hand side of these charts. Membership trends are driven by many factors that are outside of our purview. How many people retire, at what age they might retire, their personal health needs, as well as death rates. You can see in the Medicare population, it continues to be relatively stable. Historically, the declines in our Medicare population trends are impacted by that ratio of new enrollees to members passing away. 97% of our membership is enrolled in one of our Medicare plans, and 67% of those members have dental insurance. On the non-Medicare side, it's hard not to see that decline, but this is in part due to the number of lower cost options that are available on the open market. 72% of our non-Medicare members have dental insurance. And overall, as a population, 68% of our members carry dental insurance. Next, please. So program services, we have a long list here. We provide a number of essential services in order to meet our mission. Many of the tasks are annual projects, while still others include monthly, weekly, and daily work in order to make sure that our member needs are met with a high level of quality, integrity, and stewardship. As you can see from the list, we have both internal services as well as member-facing services. Next, please. Program funding. PHIP programs and services are funded entirely by post-tax member dollars, which are held in the Standard Retiree Health Insurance Account, or SREIA. That is defined in ORS 238410, and that states that the dollars that are collected can only be used for health insurance coverage and administrative expenses. We do charge a small administration fee to our members on a per member per month basis, and that's used to pay for administrative expenses like member materials, benefit books, etc. And again, the premiums are paid by our retirees. There are some subsidies available for eligible members, and those subsidy dollars are paid by the employers and held in the RIA or RIPA accounts, and we administer those funds. As you can see by the chart, the vast majority of our members pay for their pension or their premium out of pension deduct. that is an automated pull from their pension check. However, we do have members who continue to pay by check. Some members just prefer to pay by check, but more frequently it is because they're using the self-pay options while they're establishing the pension deduct service. Next, please.
Karen, this is Sadhana. Yeah. May I ask a question?
Of course.
Can you go up one slide, please? How are the premiums determined?
The premiums are determined in the rate renewal process, which is actually the next item up on the agenda. We go through what's called a renewal process every year. We work with our contracted health plans, and we look at we determine what benefits we want to be moving forward with in the coming year, which is based on member feedback from the contracted health plans, as well as updates that are occurring in the industry itself. So changes through that are being administered through the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, CMS. All of that gets incorporated into the design process. We then ask our CHPs to provide us with rates associated with those benefits. And then we look to contain that cost as much as possible to provide the best benefits to our members. And then we bring that here to you all for approval. And that is C5 on our list. So we'll get to that in just a moment. Did that answer your question, or is there other information that would help?
No, so this is a very, very tedious yearly process that you have to go through.
Yes.
Okay.
It takes many months, but the great news is we have some great, good partners, and that longstanding relationship that we have with our contracted health plans, and the knowledge that they have about the mission and operating principles of the program does enable that process to move relatively smoothly.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So Kevin, can we go to the two slides? Yes, looking ahead. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The 2021 program accomplishments, thank you. So this last year in 2021, PHIP and our partners continued to respond to membership needs. The accomplishments that you see here on this slide occurred in relation to the pandemic variants, increased testing, vaccinations, and we watched as news of federal policy proposals might impact health insurance benefits and costs as well. As the year went on and new variants arrived and mask mandates changed, the world began to open its doors again. And we focused our attention on how the pandemic might have shifted our work going forward. It may have changed our trajectory, perhaps for the better. So in May, shortly after the last board update in 2021, PHIP conducted an RFP for a health plan consultant, and we awarded that contract to Siegel Consulting, and we brought them on board in October. We spent the time between October and bringing them on board and preparing them for that first renewal process. And again, the results we'll talk about in just a few moments. We also participated in the PERS Expo. We designed a hybrid education program. And when I say we, I really mean the credit belongs with Danielle Kaiser on the team. She led the efforts to design an ongoing program that that will incorporate both what we've learned from the pandemic in ways of utilizing technology and also capitalize on the benefits of in-person events as well, which our members enjoy. We implemented a member webinars, and we updated our educational videos that were originally developed in 2020 with our 2021 information, excuse me. Getting wrapped around all of these 2020 dates. As mentioned, we access technology in 2021 and work with our partners to create webinars. This actually has enabled us to move forward this year with new enrollment meeting schedules where we weren't able to do that before due to the pandemic in which stopped us in 2020. Our first new enrollment monthly meeting was held in March of 2022. We had another one in April and another one in May. And so far, we have had more than 110 participants in each one of those meetings. So we're very pleased with the results of starting those new enrollment meetings again. We do plan to resume in-person member plan change events this fall, and we'll supplement that with webinars as needed. We'll conduct a member satisfaction survey this year, and that's currently under development. We have a goal to enhance our webpage to make it easier and more convenient of a resource for our members. And as in years past, we will participate in the PERS Expo, providing program information to help PERS members understand health insurance options that are available. And then we'll also further work with PERS to explore technological advances to improve member, team, and also our contractor experiences. Next. Are there any other questions that I can answer for you at this time? If not, I thank you all for your attention, and we can transition to C5, Retiree Health Insurance Plan Renewals and Rates.
That sounds good, Karen.
Well, good morning again, Chair Shenoy. For the record, I'm Karen Chavez, and I'm the PERS Health Insurance Program Manager, and we'll switch now to the PHIP 2023 plan benefits and rate approval. First, before we go any further, I'd like to thank the staff and our consultants and the contracted health plans for their work in achieving the success during the 2023 renewal this year. And as you indicated, it can be a very detailed process going back and forth as we negotiate the benefits and rates. Illustrated in the memo presented to the board, the PERS Health Insurance Program considered only a few factors this year in the renewal process. The consideration this year was given to the continued long-term uncertainty and impacts of COVID-19, plan design and benefit improvements in response to our interactions with PHIP members, and plan design and benefit improvements in response to our contracted health plan input or CHP input. Based on that information from our members and CHPs and the analysis of state and federal trends, we also examined the impacts of the pandemic on the renewal process this year. And our focus was the inclusion of additional benefits that offer value to PHIP members and providing continued rate and benefit stability. We did ask our six carrier partners to present rates for the 2023 benefit plan, including the addition of Adhulam, a medication for early onset Alzheimer's, as approved by CMS, and several other programs, including member incentive programs, meal delivery programs, and over-the-counter supplemental benefits. After reviewing the offerings and careful consideration, we're not recommending changes at this time to the 2023 medical benefits. This recommendation is so that PHIP and our consultants have adequate time to analyze the benefit changes and the impacts to premiums in a post-pandemic world, and consider the value and viability of future changes. We're also not recommending any changes in pharmacy or dental benefits for the same reason. We will continue, however, to evaluate the programs that were brought forward this year for future consideration. The reserve drawdown, an additional consideration for us when we're setting rates and this year and into the future is regarding the rate stabilization reserve drawdown. As you know, this was presented and approved by the board in May 2020. The policy presented at that time addressed how reserve amounts more than the contractually required amounts would be reviewed annually to determine if a portion of the excess reserves should be used to stabilize rates during the annual rate setting process. Any such use of those reserves would be included in the recommendations provided to the PERS board for approval. This year, as of December 2021, our reserve balance is about $81 million, which is down $10 million from the December 2020 rate that was presented last year. Our recommended rates this year do not include rate credits. This is due to overall favorable rates presented by the CHPs for the 2023 plan year, which were flat or a decrease compared to the best and final offers presented by CHPs in 2020. We did consider applying rate credits with various benefit strategies to continue to draw down those reserves. However, given the uncertainty of rate volatility and our recommended approach for benefit stability as we move beyond COVID-19, we were reticent to implement a strategy that might increase the volatility of rates in later years. This pause gives us time to assess the post-pandemic needs and of current and potential members and the use of those reserves. Although we're not recommending a rate credit be applied this year, we do believe this is still consistent with the board's adoption of the 9-year drawdown option and the guidelines provided in PERS policy. The rates for benefits for 2023 were included in the attachment one to this memo.
Ms. Chavez, this is Steve Buckley.
Yes, sir.
Am I correct in looking at the charts that some of the rates are flat, some of the rates have decreased, and some of the projected rates have increased?
Thank you for calling that out, Board Member Buckley. On that chart, what you're seeing, last year, the rates that were approved, and so what you're seeing on that chart for 2022 plan rates includes a rate credit. So what is in the 2023 column does not include a rate credit. So when we looked at the best and final rates that were presented by the contracted health plans for 2022 and the best and final rates that were offered by the contracted health plans for 2023, they were flat or decreased for the most part. So that's what's creating the discrepancy in what you're seeing on that chart.
Well, could we go to the chart for a minute to make sure I'm reading this correctly? So, for example, on the MODA Health Medicare Supplement, is the rate increasing 3.94% this year?
Yes. But compared to the 2022 rates,
right. And the reason that you're proposing not to use the subsidy, a portion of the subsidy or the rate credit this year, is that you think that that helps maintain stability and perhaps would result in a less severe increase in 2024?
Yes, sir. That's correct. We're trying to...
Has the advisory committee weighed in on whether to use the subsidy this year to reduce member rates?
Board Member Buckley, we don't currently have an advisory committee that's in play. That's something that has been under restructure, and we have not gotten that up and running at this point.
And was the practice in last year, 2022, to provide the rate credit or the subsidy across the board as opposed to just those health plans that had increases?
We look at how to apply in the policy, we have a set of principles that we utilize each year when we look at applying a rate credit, and those are applied across all CHPs, not just for one or two. We look at how that's going to impact the equity across the all of our plans.
Board Member Buckley, if I may ask a connected question. When I look at this, and maybe this has been in the materials in the past, but I think certainly with private plans and what we experienced at my company, utilization behaviors were very strange in 2020 and 21. And we built up reserves during that time, and now we're seeing that start to stabilize. Did you experience something similar within these plans?
We have seen stabilization of the utilization. It hasn't been fully recovered, and there are likely some changes in utilization going forward that as people deferred their services over that time. We aren't sure how to anticipate people's yeah. use of those services going forward and what that's going to look like.
Yeah, thank you. Very helpful. So Board Member Buckley, that's one of the reasons why I felt it might have been appropriate not to touch the crediting sure. reserve, because we haven't really returned to a stable run rate. Mm-hmm. I do have one other unrelated question. If you want any follow-up on that, please go ahead.
No, I just wanted to stir the discussion about whether that subsidy should be applied this year, and delve into a little more detail as to why the recommendation was not to use a portion of the subsidy this year. So
thank you very much. A question about the non-Medicare plans, and I recognize they're relatively small on an enrollment basis, but are the increases we're seeing in the United Healthcare plans a consequence of declining enrollment in the plans and we're starting to see adverse selection, or is there something else driving that?
That may be a part of it. I can't speak for the United Healthcare plan at this point. What we do know, however, is that we have a small pool. That pool, and it being elderly, on the higher end, not being mixed with a larger pool of healthier individuals, younger and healthier individuals on a statistical basis, that helps drive those prices of non-Medicare higher. And then the non-Medicare plans as offered by United Healthcare is specific to the services that they offer for that plan and is driven by what they believe is their best rates.
Very helpful. Thank you.
So this is Sadhana Shenoy. Quick question. The reason I asked about determination of rates earlier on before Section C5 was actually kind of exactly talking about what the board members have just been discussing. When you talk to your CHPs, is there an inclusion in conversation about what they anticipate going forward, especially coming out of COVID?
Thank you for that question, Chair Shenoy. We meet on a quarterly basis with our CHPs. And over the last couple of years, we've been monitoring with them the impacts of COVID-19 and how that's impacting services and what they anticipate. Everyone has an idea, but we don't necessarily know what that's going to look like for certain. But we do engage with them. We actually have another meeting coming up with our CHPs on the 8th of June, and we have asked them to provide us with ideas about what trends they can anticipate going forward, so that as we're building 2023 and 2024 and we're monitoring this, we have a better idea of how to strategically plan for benefits as we go forward.
Okay. And then the question I had about the rate stabilization reserve drawdown is that reserve has to be drawn down over a certain number of years. Right. And since we are at the beginning of that period, you are suggesting that it's better to not make any drawdowns and wait for maybe some more adverse circumstances? Or is it because the rates haven't gone up as much as you thought they would?
It's a little bit of both, Chair Shenoy. It was a favorable year with a rate decrease overall or flat rates, best and final offer to best and final offer from 2022 to 2023. So that impacted our decision, as well as, as we return to a more normal, air quoting this here, a more normal utilization of services, we're hoping to that by looking at this year without a rate credit, we can actually see how this is going to play out. We'll know more about policy as we go forward in the Medicare sphere, and give us time to build a good strategy for how to utilize these funds and draw this down more strategically on a longer term basis and not just on a year to year basis. So this gives us an opportunity with our new consultants to re-baseline based on the market.
Okay, thank you. And then again, this is just more of your experience that I'm questioning. Meaning, I'm asking the question of your experience. How are our rates within PERS compared to outside. And I'm trying to see why there has been a drop in the enrollment, and to see if it has anything to do with the rates that we are quoting.
There's two pieces to that, Chair Shenoy. One is how our rates compare. Our rates are comparable to the marketplace. Our benefits are a little bit richer than what you'll find out there on the market. So there's that component. And then you had a second question as far as the enrollment and why that might be dropping. Again, we believe that with there's lower rate options out there in the marketplace. A lot of state employees can choose to stay with PEB for non-Medicare. And so because they have a larger pool, they can offer lower prices. There's also with ACA and the exchange, there's greater options out there in the commercial market. So this is one of the strategy questions that we have slated for later this year to discuss is what do we need to know about the non-Medicare, not only enrollment, but the plan itself, and how do we structure that so that we can provide a more competitive price for non-members or for members and try and engage more people into that plan. And understand what we don't know. If there's something we're not thinking about, then we want to include that in the discussion and then present new options potentially going forward.
And then the last question I had is, have you done any surveys of the people who do choose to buy these insurance plans? And what kind of feedback have you received?
Excuse me. We ask our current members every 2 years. We have a member satisfaction survey. We have another one going out this year, and we're in development of that currently. So we will be asking questions about the satisfaction of the services. At this time, I don't know that we are asking questions such as what makes you choose something other than PHIP. We're not asking other PERS retirees that are non-PHIP members what drives that choice.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no further questions at this time, we come to the portion of our conversation where I present you with some options. The board may pass a motion to approve the proposed PHIP contract renewals, benefits, and rates for the 2022 plan year as presented in item C5 attachment 1, or you can direct staff to make changes to these terms and explore other options. Our recommendation at this time is for the board to approve the contract renewals, benefits, and rates for 2023 as presented in option 1.
This is Board Member Scanlon. I move to approve the PHIP contract renewals, benefits, and rates for 2023.
This is Board Member Jaramillo. Second.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you very much to everyone. So moved.
Thank you very much.
Chair Shenoy, can I take a moment to speak on this?
Please.
I had the opportunity to sit in on all the meetings with Karen and her team when the CHPs were asked to explain the benefits and costs and how that worked, and felt a little bit like the child that first gets to sit at the grown-up table, you know, happy to be there, but not understanding everything that's going on around me. But I did get the sense of Karen's team that they were just really impressive and very passionate about ensuring the retirees getting the best value for their money. They asked hard questions and they held the providers accountable. So just want to extend kudos to Karen and her team. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Scanlon. Kevin, anything else?
Chair Shinoy, there's nothing else that I'm aware of that we need to discuss today. Thank you.
Okay. And in that case, we have come to the end of our agenda. Thank you, everyone, for participating in this meeting. We have a holiday coming up. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. And we will see you all next meeting, July 22nd. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.